San Francisco, California. Japantown. March 9th, 1969. Sunday evening. Time, 7:38 p.m. The dojo was on the second floor of a narrow building on Post Street, above a tea shop that had been closed since 5. The staircase was steep, wooden, and worn smooth by decades of feet. The walls smelled of cedar, floor wax, and something sharper underneath. Effort. Years of it. There were 34 people inside that room when it happened. 34. Most were men. Judoka. Black belts. Competitors. Trainers. A few instructors from neighboring schools, who had been invited by word of mouth to witness something they had been told they would not forget. They didn't, but not for the reason they expected, because none of them had come to see Bruce Lee. They had come to see her. They had come to see the woman who, over the previous 14 months, had thrown every male challenger who had stepped onto the mat with her in sanctioned and unsanctioned judo exchanges across 3 states. 41 men, 41 throws, no defeats, no stalemates, no controversy. She did not win because her opponents went easy. She won because they couldn't stop her. And on that particular evening, in a room full of men who understood exactly how difficult that was, the last person anyone expected to walk through the door was a man who had built his entire philosophy around never being taken to the ground. But he did walk through the door. And what happened in the next 11 minutes was talked about in dojos, gyms, and private training halls from San Francisco to Tokyo for years afterward. Not because Bruce Lee won, not because she won, but because what happened between them revealed something most martial artists spend their entire lives trying to understand and never quite do. This is that story. The Kenshin Judo Academy was not famous. It was respected, which in the world of serious martial arts is more valuable. Famous schools attract visitors. Respected schools attract practitioners. The difference is intention. The building itself offered nothing to the eye. No sign in English. A small brass plate beside the street-level door, with 3 kanji characters that most passers-by could not read. A buzzer that didn't always work. A staircase that groaned under weight. But inside, the second-floor training hall was beautiful, in the way that disciplined spaces always are. The floor was tatami, real tatami, imported, maintained with the kind of attention that only people who have been thrown onto a bad surface understand. The walls were plain, cream-colored plaster over old lath, no mirrors, no motivational posters, no photographs of famous athletes. A small wooden shrine sat in one corner. Beside it, a framed photograph of Jigoro Kano, the founder of judo. Nothing else decorated the room. The ceiling was low enough that a tall man extending both arms upward could touch it with his fingertips. The lighting was warm but not bright. 2 rows of wooden benches lined the east wall. A single window at the far end looked out over Post Street, where the evening fog had already begun to crawl through the neighborhood like a slow tide. The dojo was run by a man named Hiroshi Tanaka. Tanaka Sensei was 61 years old, small, precise, and utterly uninterested in anything that did not serve the mat. He had trained in Kodokan Judo in Tokyo before the war. He had emigrated to San Francisco in 1948. He had opened his school in 1952. He had never advertised. He had never needed to. His students came because other students told them to. His reputation was simple. If you trained under Tanaka, you understood how the ground worked, not theoretically, physically. Your body learned to feel balance before your mind could name it. Your hands learned to read intention through fabric. Your hips learned that the shortest distance to the floor is not down. It is through whoever is standing in your way. Tanaka had produced 3 national-level competitors, 2 Pan American medalists, and 1 woman who, by March of 1969, had become the most quietly terrifying grappler on the West Coast. Her name was Keiko Murakami. Keiko Murakami did not look like what most men expected when they heard the word fighter. That was, in many ways, her greatest weapon. She was 5 feet 4 inches tall. She weighed 128 pounds. Her build was compact, but not thick. Functional. Dense in the way that gymnasts and wrestlers are dense. Muscle that did not announce itself, but could not be ignored once it engaged. Her face was calm. Symmetrical. Unremarkable at a distance. But up close, there was something in her expression that careful people noticed and careless people missed. Stillness. The same kind of stillness that experienced animals carry. not passivity, readiness disguised as patience. Keiko had begun judo at the age of 6 in Osaka, Japan. Her father, Takeshi Murakami, was a fourth dan judoka who ran a small neighborhood dojo that smelled of old mats and persistence. He had wanted sons. He had been given 2 daughters. The older one hated the mat. The younger one loved it with a ferocity that startled him. By the age of 8, Keiko was training with boys twice her age. By 10, she was throwing them. By 12, the boy's parents began to complain, not because she was dangerous, because she was better. And in 1950s Japan, a girl who could throw boys was not celebrated. She was a problem. Her father moved the family to San Francisco when she was 14, officially for work, unofficially because he understood that his daughter's talent would be crushed by a culture that could not yet accept it. In America, the situation was different. Not better, just different. Instead of cultural disapproval, Keiko faced disbelief. American martial artists did not take female grapplers seriously. Not in the 1960s. Not in judo, which was still overwhelmingly male. Not in a country where women's martial arts were largely limited to self-defense classes taught in church basements. Keiko did not care about being taken seriously. She cared about the mat. She trained under Tanaka Sensei 6 days a week, 4 hours a day, for 9 years. By the age of 23, she held a 3rd Dan black belt. She had competed in 7 regional tournaments, winning 6. The 7th she lost on a controversial referee decision that 3 senior judges later said privately was incorrect. But competition was not where her reputation was truly built. Her reputation was built in the practice sessions, in randori, free sparring, open mat exchanges where rank, gender and expectation vanished and only ability remained. In those sessions, Keiko was devastating. Her grip was the first thing men noticed. It did not feel like a woman's grip. It did not feel like a man's grip. It felt like a fact. Once she held your collar or your sleeve, options began to disappear, not dramatically, gradually, like a room slowly losing light. Her throws were not the explosive, acrobatic kind that won tournament points. They were structural. She found the line your balance depended on, and then she removed it, quietly, efficiently, without warning. Men described the experience the same way. I didn't know I was falling until I was already on the ground. By early 1969, word had spread beyond Tanaka's dojo. Judoka from other schools began visiting specifically to test themselves against her. Some came respectfully. Some came skeptically. A few came with the poorly hidden intention of restoring order to what they considered an uncomfortable hierarchy. All of them ended up on the mat. 41 men in 14 months. Keiko never boasted about the number. She barely acknowledged it. When asked, she simply said, "They chose to test. The mat decided." But the number was known. And the number was why, on March 9th, 1969, 34 people had gathered in Tanaka's dojo to watch a special open mat session that Tanaka had organized. Not a tournament, not a demonstration, something rarer, an invitation. The room was already full by 7:15. The wooden benches along the east wall held about 20. The rest stood along the north side, arms folded or hands in pockets, speaking quietly. The atmosphere was not casual. It was restrained in the way that martial arts gatherings often are when something unscripted is about to happen. Tanaka-sensei had sent word through trusted channels that Keiko would hold an open session. Any visiting practitioner was welcome to engage in standing randori. No striking, no ground submissions. Judo rules, standing throws only. It was framed as practice. Everyone understood it was more than that. The men who had come were not beginners. Several held ranks of 2nd and 3rd Dan. 2 were former competitors. 1 was an instructor from a school in Oakland who had been training for 20 years and had never been thrown by a woman. He intended to keep that record. Keiko was already on the mat when most of them arrived. She wore a white gi, clean and pressed. Her belt was tied with the unconscious precision of someone who had tied it 10,000 times. Her hair was pulled back tightly. She was warming up alone, performing uchikomi, repetitive entry drills. The same hip movement, the same hand position, the same angle of rotation, again and again and again, each repetition identical, each one slightly faster. No music, no conversation, just the sound of bare feet on tatami and the soft whisper of cotton. The visitors watched her warm up with varying degrees of attention. Some studied her movement carefully and said nothing. Others glanced and looked away, already forming conclusions based on her size. The instructor from Oakland turned to the man beside him and said, just loudly enough to be heard, "I give her credit for courage." He meant it as a compliment. It landed as a measurement. Tanaka-sensei called the room to attention at 7:30. He spoke briefly. In Japanese first, then in English. "Tonight, we practice honestly. Anyone who wishes to engage with Keiko is welcome. Standing judo. Mutual respect. Begin and end with a bow. Simple. Clean. No theater." The first man stepped forward almost immediately. A second Dan from Sacramento. Tall. Long arms. Good posture. He bowed. Keiko bowed. They gripped. 18 seconds later, he was on his back. He lay there for a moment, blinking. Then he sat up, nodded, and returned to the bench. The second man lasted slightly longer. 26 seconds. He attempted a foot sweep. She read it, redirected his weight, and used his own momentum to execute a clean hip throw that landed him flat with a sound that made two men near the window wince. The third man was more careful. He circled. He adjusted grips. He tested her reactions with small tugs and shifts of weight. Keiko allowed it for about 40 seconds. Then she attacked. A combination entry. Left hand controlling the sleeve. Right hand driving under the collar. Hip rotation that seemed to begin before her feet had fully committed. He went airborne for a moment. Not long, but long enough for every experienced judoka in the room to understand the throw was technically perfect. Three men. Three throws. Under 2 minutes total. The room adjusted. The murmuring quieted. The instructor from Oakland did not volunteer. A fourth man did. Then a fifth. The fifth was the biggest man in the room, 6'2", over 200 pounds, former collegiate wrestler who had transitioned to judo 3 years earlier. He lasted longer, nearly 90 seconds. He used his weight well. He denied her the grips she wanted. He pressured forward. Keiko did not panic. She circled patiently, waited for the overcommitment she knew would come, and when it did, when his right foot planted a fraction too wide and his shoulder line tilted forward, she dropped under him with a timing so precise that his size became the instrument of his own fall. He hit the mat hard. The room exhaled. Five men, five throws, no one else stood up. Tanaka-sensei looked across the room with an expression that was neither proud nor disappointed. Simply present. The silence stretched, and then the door at the top of the staircase opened. No one had been told he was coming. Later, several people in the room would claim they knew. They didn't. Tanaka-sensei himself would later admit that the visit was unexpected. He had met Bruce Lee once before. Briefly, at a martial arts gathering in Los Angeles the previous year, they had exchanged perhaps 5 minutes of conversation. Cordial. Professional. Nothing more. How Bruce Lee learned about the session was never fully established. Someone told someone who told someone. That was how things moved in the martial arts world of 1960s San Francisco. Word traveled through handshakes and trust. The door opened. A man stepped inside. He was wearing dark trousers and a fitted black shirt. No jacket tonight. No gi. No formal attire. He stood at the threshold for a moment, scanning the room with the quick efficiency of someone who processed environments the way most people processed sentences. Tanaka recognized him immediately. Two of the visiting judoka did as well. One of them, a man who had attended the 1964 Long Beach International Karate Championship, where Lee had given his famous demonstration, straightened visibly. The rest of the room registered only what they saw. A lean man. Young. Asian. Average height. Not large. Quiet. Nothing threatening. Nothing special. At least, not to the untrained eye. Bruce Lee gave a slight bow toward Tanaka from the doorway. Tanaka returned it and gestured him inside. Lee entered, removed his shoes, walked to the edge of the mat. He did not sit on the benches. He stood, hands relaxed at his sides, feet naturally positioned, weight centered. Several men near him noticed something about the way he stood. Not tense. Not loose. Present. As though his body had already adjusted to the room before his mind had finished observing it. Tanaka-sensei approached him. They spoke quietly for a moment. In the room's silence, fragments carried. "She is exceptional. I came to see for myself. You are welcome to observe. Then Tanaka said something that the nearest bench heard clearly. Or participate, if you wish. Bruce Lee looked at the mat, then at Keiko. She was standing alone in the center of the tatami, retying her belt. She had not looked at the door when it opened. She had not reacted to the quiet shift in the room's attention. She finished her belt, adjusted her collar, and then turned toward the new presence she could feel but had not yet identified. Their eyes met across the mat. Neither reacted visibly, but something entered the room that had not been there a moment before. Not hostility. Curiosity. The kind of curiosity that only occurs when two people who have mastered different systems of understanding the body recognize, even from a distance, that the other person is not ordinary. Bruce Lee looked back at Tanaka. May I? Tanaka paused. It was a real pause. Not theatrical. Tanaka was weighing something. He knew who Bruce Lee was. He knew what Bruce Lee could do. He also knew that his student was not a props for another man's demonstration. He looked at Keiko. It is her decision, he said. Bruce Lee nodded. He stepped to the edge of the mat and addressed Keiko directly. I've heard what you can do, he said. His voice was calm, respectful, but direct. I train in a different system. Striking. Interception. I have very little formal ground training. The honesty of that sentence shifted the atmosphere. Men who declare weakness before engagement are either foolish or confident in something deeper than the weakness they've named. Keiko studied him. She had thrown 41 men. She had learned to read bodies the way musicians read sound, and what she read now did not match what she saw. He was smaller than most of her opponents. He was lighter. He had no gi for her to grip, but the way he stood suggested something she had only encountered a handful of times. Balance that was not maintained. Balance that was inhabited. You want to stand with me? She asked. I want to learn what happens when my system meets yours, he said. A faint murmur moved through the room. Keiko glanced once at Tanaka. He gave the smallest nod. She turned back to Bruce Lee. Then, step on the mat. Bruce Lee stepped onto the tatami barefoot. The surface was different from what he was used to. Softer. Grippier. Designed for falls, not footwork. He felt it immediately. He adjusted. Keiko noticed. She noticed because most men who stepped onto a judo mat for the first time from outside the discipline did not adjust at all. They moved the same way they always moved and trusted their habits to carry them through unfamiliar terrain. This man had changed his base width within two steps. That told her something important. He was not arrogant. He was adaptive. They stood 4 feet apart in the center of the mat. The room had gone absolutely still. 34 people watching, every one of them trained. Every one of them capable of understanding what they were about to see at a level that untrained spectators could never reach. Keiko extended her hands in the traditional judo grip fighting position, open palms forward, elbows slightly bent. She was offering the engagement. Bruce Lee did not mirror her. He adopted a modified stance, lead hand slightly extended, rear hand low, feet angled, not a judo stance, not a boxing stance, something else. Something between interception and evasion. Keiko moved first. She reached for his collar with her right hand and his sleeve with her left. Standard kumikata. The opening grip exchange that every judo match begins with. Bruce Lee's hand met hers before contact. Not a block, a deflection. His forearm redirected her reaching hand just enough to deny the collar grip. At the same time, his rear hand checked her left. Two small movements, precise. Simultaneous. Keiko felt it and recognized what had happened. He had not defended. He had intercepted. The difference mattered enormously. Defense reacts to what has arrived. Interception meets what is arriving. She tried again. This time faster. A sharp pull-grip attempt that most men could not prevent. Bruce Lee circled half a step and neutralized the angle. Keiko felt her position shift. She was no longer facing his center. She was facing his side. In judo, facing someone's side without a grip is a disadvantage. It means your strongest throwing lines are misaligned. She reset instantly. Bruce Lee allowed it. That was the second thing that surprised her. He was not pressing an advantage. He was observing. She came again. Third attempt. This time she combined the grip attempt with a foot movement. A small step designed to close distance and deny the circling pattern she had already identified. Bruce Lee's lead foot moved. Not away, across, He cut the angle she was creating and placed himself in a position where her forward momentum carried her past the point of maximum grip efficiency. Her hands closed on air and fabric that was already moving. No grip established. Three attempts, three denials. The room shifted. A soft sound, not quite a gasp, not quite a whisper, moved along the benches. Several of the visiting judoka exchanged glances. They understood what they were seeing. A man with no formal judo training was neutralizing one of the best grip fighters in the state. Not with judo, with something else. Distance management, timing, the ability to read intention and arrive at the solution before the problem fully formed. Keiko stepped back half a pace. She was not frustrated. She was recalibrating, and in that brief pause, Bruce Lee spoke. "Your entries are faster than anything I've faced," he said. It was not flattery. It was data. She acknowledged with the slightest nod. Then she changed strategy entirely. Keiko stopped reaching. That was the first sign of danger. When a judoka stops reaching for grips, it means they have decided to use something other than the opening exchange to create the throw. It means they are going to make you come to them. Or it means they are about to do something you haven't seen yet. She shifted her weight back slightly. Her hands lowered. Her breathing slowed. Bruce Lee noticed the change immediately. She was no longer in pursuit mode. She was in reading mode. Two people standing still on a mat. Both trained to read the other's body. Both waiting for the first honest movement. The room held its breath. Then Bruce Lee did something unexpected. He moved forward. Not an attack. A test. A half-step entry with his lead hand extended. The kind of movement that in his system was designed to provoke a reaction. A probe. A question asked with the body rather than the mouth. Keiko answered it. She moved laterally, let his hand pass, and then did something that happened so fast the nearest bench barely tracked it. She gripped. Not the collar, not the sleeve, his wrist. In judo, wrist grips are unconventional. In competition, they are sometimes penalized. But on the open mat, in randori, between two people operating outside the rules, a wrist grip from a master grappler is a doorway to destruction. Bruce Lee felt it. Later, he would describe the sensation to a training partner as unlike anything he had encountered. Not strength. Certainly not brute force. Something more precise, like a key fitting into a lock. She pulled. Not hard. Smart. She pulled along the exact line where his forward momentum was already traveling, adding her force to his own. At the same time she entered. One step. Her hip appeared in the space between his center and the floor, with an accuracy that defied the casualness of her movement. Bruce Lee's feet left the mat. The room inhaled. His body rotated, not wildly. Her throw was controlled. Hip throw. Ogoshi, one of the most fundamental techniques in judo. But the way she executed it was not fundamental. It was surgical. She did not heave him. She directed him. He hit the tummy. The sound was clean, flat, definitive. Not the thunderous crash of the earlier throws against larger men. Something more precise. He was on his back. She was standing. One technique. One result. The room did not cheer. The room held absolutely still. Because 34 martial artists had just watched something they did not fully know how to process. Bruce Lee. Thrown. On his back. On a judo mat. In Japantown. By a woman who weighed less than he did. Keiko maintained her grip for a moment. In competition, the throw would have scored ippon. Full point. Match over. But this was not competition. She released him. Bruce Lee lay on his back for precisely 2 seconds. That mattered. A lesser man would have jumped up immediately. Ego demands speed after embarrassment. The body obeys pride before it obeys intelligence. Bruce Lee did not jump. He lay still for 2 seconds. Processed. Then rose smoothly, not quickly, not slowly. The way a man rises who has experienced something new and intends to understand it rather than escape it. He stood before her. The room was silent. Several men on the benches leaned forward. The instructor from Oakland, who had not volunteered against Keiko all evening, was gripping his own knees without realizing it. Bruce Lee looked at Keiko. His expression was not what anyone expected. No embarrassment. No frustration, no mask of indifference, interest, genuine, visible, unguarded interest. Again, he said. Keiko studied him. She had thrown 42 people now. None of them had asked for a second engagement with that word. Again, not let me try again, not one more time, not I wasn't ready, just again, as if the throw had given him something valuable and he wanted more of it. She nodded. They reset. This time, something had changed. Bruce Lee's stance was lower. Not much. Perhaps 2 inches. But those 2 inches meant his center of gravity was harder to access. His weight distribution had shifted. He was no longer balanced for forward interception. He was balanced for lateral movement with downward base. He had adapted. In the span of 10 seconds, between the fall and the reset, he had read what she did, identified the vulnerability she exploited, and restructured his foundation to deny it. Keiko recognized the adjustment, and for the first time all evening, something shifted in her expression. Not concern, respect. The kind of respect that arises when one practitioner realizes another is learning in real time at a speed that should not be possible. She moved. Same entry angle as before, same grip attempt, same line. Bruce Lee's response was different. His hips dropped slightly at the moment she entered. His lead arm did not deflect this time. It occupied the space her grip hand needed to travel through. Not a block, a presence, a denial of territory. She adjusted, found a different collar line. He rotated. Not much. Enough. Her hip entry missed its target by 3 inches. In judo, 3 inches is the difference between a perfect throw and standing awkwardly close to someone who now has options you did not intend to give them. Bruce Lee's hand touched her elbow. Not struck. Touched. He redirected her rotation, just enough to cancel the throw, then stepped through the space she had created, and emerged on the other side of her body position, with his balance intact and hers compromised. She did not fall. She was too good for that. But she stumbled. One step. One single corrective step. In a room full of men she had thrown without effort, that single step was seismic. A breath moved through the watchers. Keiko recovered instantly. Reset. Looked at him. And now the room felt something it had not felt before. Equality. 2 systems. 2 bodies. 2 lifetimes of training. Neither dominant. Neither conceding. Both operating at a level of skill that made the space between them feel smaller than the physical distance suggested. The third engagement lasted longer than either of the first two. It lasted perhaps 90 seconds. But for the people watching, it expanded beyond measurement. Keiko attacked and adjusted. Bruce Lee intercepted and adapted. She found grips. He neutralized them. She changed angles. He rotated. She dropped levels. He restructured. Then she found something. A moment. A fraction of a second, where his weight transitioned between patterns. Her hand closed on his forearm. Her other hand found the back of his collar. She had him. Full grip, strong position, throwing line established. She entered hard, hips under him, back turned, full commitment. The throw began. Bruce Lee's body started to leave the ground. And then something happened that Keiko did not anticipate. He did not resist the throw. He entered it. Instead of fighting the rotation, he accelerated with it. His body curled. His hand found her guide, not to grip, to guide. He turned the throw into a controlled fall, and used the rotation to land not flat on his back, but on his side, already moving, already turning. He converted a clean epon into a scramble. And in the scramble, for one brief instant, his forearm crossed her centerline and stopped, 1 inch from her collarbone. Not a strike, a marker, a quiet statement. In my system, this is where it would end. Keiko felt it. She understood it. They both froze. The room froze with them. 2 people locked in a position that belonged to neither judo nor Jeet Kune Do, but to the honest space between them, where both systems had expressed their truth simultaneously. She had thrown him. He had survived it and arrived at a finishing position. Both things were real. Both things were true. Neither had defeated the other. Both had proven something. Bruce Lee withdrew his arm. Keiko released her grip. They separated, stood, faced each other, and for the first time that evening, Keiko smiled. It was small. It was real. It meant she understood what had just happened better than anyone watching from the benches. Bruce Lee returned the expression. Not a wide smile, a recognition, the kind of acknowledgement that only passes between people who have genuinely tested each other and found something worthy on the other side. The room waited. No one moved. No one knew how to respond, because what they had witnessed did not fit any narrative they had arrived with. The men who had come expecting Bruce Lee to be thrown had seen him thrown. The men who had come expecting Bruce Lee to dominate had seen him adapt. The men who had expected a winner had been given something more unsettling, a conversation, an honest, physical conversation between two systems that should not have been able to communicate and yet did. Bruce Lee spoke first. "Your hip entry is the fastest I've ever encountered," Keiko acknowledged with a nod. "Your interception," she said, choosing the word carefully, "makes gripping feel like guessing." Bruce Lee looked at her for a long moment. "May I ask you something?" "Yes." "When you threw me the first time, where did you read the opening?" She considered the question seriously, respectfully. "Your forward step carried commitment past the point of recovery. Once the weight was there, I only had to show it where to go." Bruce Lee closed his eyes briefly, processing. "I teach my students that same principle," he said, "in striking, in everything." Keiko tilted her head. "Then you understand that what I do is not strength. I understood it the moment I hit the mat." That sentence settled over the room like something heavy and permanent. Tanaka Sensei, who had watched the entire exchange in absolute stillness, uncrossed his arms. He did not speak. He did not need to. His expression carried everything. The quiet satisfaction of a man whose student had just been recognized at the deepest level by someone worthy of offering recognition. Bruce Lee turned to Tanaka and bowed. Not a casual bow, a real one. The kind of bow that says, "Your school taught something I did not know, and I am grateful for the lesson." Tanaka returned it. Then Bruce Lee turned back to Keiko. "I have spent years building a system that avoids the ground," he said. "You've shown me why avoidance is not the same as understanding." That line hit the room with unusual force, because it contained a confession that most martial artists would never make. Bruce Lee was admitting a gap. Not a weakness, a gap. And the distinction mattered. A weakness is something you hide. A gap is something you acknowledge and prepare to close. Keiko nodded. "And you've shown me," she said, "that there is a distance before the grip where I have no answer." Bruce Lee looked at her with something that the nearest observers could only describe as warmth. "Then we both leave with something." "Yes. That," Bruce Lee said, "is the only honest outcome of a real exchange." Bruce Lee stayed at the dojo for another 40 minutes after the exchange ended. He did not demonstrate. He did not teach. He asked questions. He asked Keiko about grip theory, about how judoka read weight transfer through fabric, about the moment a throw becomes inevitable versus the moment it is still only a possibility. She answered thoroughly. Not because he was famous, because he was asking the right questions. The kind of questions that only someone who had felt the technique from the inside would know to ask. He also asked Tanaka about training methodology, how long it took to develop sensitivity in the hands, whether grip endurance could be trained separately from technique, whether the principles of kuzushi, balance breaking, could be applied to striking arts. Tanaka answered carefully. He was a man who did not waste words. "Kuzushi," he said, "is not a technique. It is a relationship between your intention and the other person's balance. If you understand that relationship, you can break balance without touching." Bruce Lee went very still when he heard that. He asked Tanaka to repeat it. Tanaka did. Bruce Lee said nothing for several seconds. Then, "That is exactly what I have been trying to teach, but I have been teaching it only through the hands. You teach it through the whole body." Tanaka nodded. "The hands lie," Tanaka said. "The hips do not." Several people in the room heard that exchange. At least two of them wrote it down afterward. One included it in a letter to a training partner in Los Angeles that was later shared privately among martial arts instructors who collected rare accounts of Bruce Lee's interactions outside his own school. By 9:15, Bruce Lee was preparing to leave. He thanked Tanaka again. He turned to Keiko one final time. "If I send students to you," he said, "will you teach them what you taught me tonight?" Keiko paused. "What did I teach you?" Bruce Lee smiled. "That the ground is not a place to avoid. It is a place to understand." Keiko looked at him for a moment. Then she gave the faintest bow. "Send them." Bruce Lee returned the bow. He walked to the edge of the mat, stepped off the tatami, put on his shoes, and descended the narrow staircase in silence. The room did not erupt. This was not that kind of story. No one cheered. No one clapped. What filled the room instead was something quieter and more valuable. Understanding. The understanding that what they had witnessed was not a fight. It was an education. Two masters, two systems, two philosophies, and between them, the rarest thing in martial arts, mutual honesty. In the months that followed, small things changed. Bruce Lee began incorporating grappling awareness into his Jeet Kune Do curriculum, not judo itself, not the gi work, not the competition format, but the principles underneath it. Weight reading, balance disruption through proximity, the recognition that a striker who does not understand the ground is a striker who has not yet been truly tested. He mentioned Keiko's name to at least three students. Dan Inosanto later recalled Bruce saying, "There is a woman in San Francisco who understands balance better than most men I've trained with." When asked who, Bruce said only, "Someone who earned the right not to need my name attached to hers." That answer said more about his respect than any public statement could have. As for Keiko, the experience did not change her daily life dramatically. She continued to train, she continued to teach, she continued to throw men who thought they knew what they were stepping into, but she did change one thing. She began training striking awareness, not to become a striker, to understand the distance before the grip, the distance Bruce Lee had exposed, the space where her hands had no answer. She later told a student that the most important lesson she ever received from a martial artist outside judo came not from a throw or a technique, but from a gap. "He showed me the space where I was blind," she said, "and he showed me without hurting me. That is the mark of a real teacher." One of the visiting judoka from that evening, a man named Robert Hayashi, wrote a short account of the exchange in a letter to a friend 5 years later. The letter contained one paragraph that survived in private circulation. "I have seen hundreds of judo matches. I have seen men throw and be thrown at the highest level of competition. But I have never seen two people communicate as honestly as Bruce Lee and Keiko Murakami did that night. They did not fight. They translated. Each one spoke a language the other had never learned. And by the end of it, both were beginning to understand." That may be the most accurate summary of what happened, because the evening in Japantown was not about winning. It was about something rarer. Two people who had mastered different truths meeting in a space where both truths could exist at the same time without one having to destroy the other. That almost never happens. In martial arts or anywhere else, in the end, the people who were there that night did not remember it as the time Bruce Lee was thrown by a woman. That would have been too simple and too small. They remembered it as the night two forms of mastery recognized each other. The night strength met structure and neither flinched. The night a striker learned to respect the ground and a grappler learned to respect the distance before the grip. The night a room full of martial artists expected a contest and witnessed a conversation instead, because the greatest exchanges between masters are never measured by who hits the mat. They are measured by who leaves the room having understood something they did not understand before they entered it. And on that count, both of them won.